Okay, ready for part two? As we were saying last night, this is a path that is leading in the direction of real happiness. We talked about some underlying principles about cultivating wholesome states of well-being, about being present for that gladness that can arise in the middle of a wholesome state, and that over time, as you practice that cultivation and connecting with the gladness, that that you start to incline the mind in a different direction, that you start to change your default setting. It's one way that I think of it. So that moving from greed, hatred, and delusion, or attachment, aversion, and ignorance, we start to move towards the wholesome, more generosity of heart, and kindness and wisdom. And then started to go through some of the wholesome states that I find particularly powerful and important to cultivate and be present for. Namely, yesterday we talked about the intention for well-being to be in the center of your life, and how mindfulness both weakens the unwholesome states and strengthens the wholesome states. And also, when you apply mindfulness to a wholesome state that's here, it amplifies it. I wonder how many people, if you experiment with that today, in the middle of a moment of well-being, if you had one or more, to hang out with it and really let yourself experience it. Anybody try that? Mm. Oh, fantastic! It's good, isn't it? Yeah. Oh, wow! That really makes me happy to see all those hands. And then last night, the third particular wholesome state that I spoke of, that is a very direct avenue to an open heart, is gratitude. And when you're feeling that blessing, to really not just know, oh yes, I'm blessed, but to feel what it's like. As I said, it's one thing to know, oh, I'm feeling good right now. It's another to know, oh, this is what it feels like to feel good. One thing I didn't mention about gratitude to keep in mind is that it's one thing to have the thought of appreciation, but when you express it in words or in deeds, the karmic impact is much greater, because thoughts have a particular power, as you've seen, of course. Thoughts come and go, and they can affect us. You know, remember when we did that trouble and kindness? Did we do that in this? Oh, no, we didn't do it. That you've seen thoughts have power. A random thought comes in, and all of a sudden it can shake you. Let's do that, actually. Just try this, okay? I'll say a word, and just notice what happens. Trouble. Notice what it feels like inside. Notice what images or associations. Notice how it feels. Trouble. Okay, now take a nice breath. I won't leave you here. I'll say another word. Kindness. Kindness. Again, notice how it feels inside, how the body feels and the mind and the heart. Kindness. Okay, you can open your eyes. Notice any difference? And those are just two words not connected to anything, just came out of my mouth, plopped into your consciousness, and So can you imagine when you keep on repeating certain thoughts over and over and over, the effect on the whole system? So mindfulness is powerful in interrupting those thoughts. That reminds me, I'll just do one more thing. It's starting to feel, smell the trouble. Is it too strong? Maybe we should close it. I don't know. Here, this is just to show you how mindfulness works, another good example of how mindfulness works, and we'll get on to the others. But so that thoughts have such power, and I started to say that you don't have much control over what thoughts you have, but when they're put into words or actions, whether it's negative or positive, the karmic impact is much, much greater. So no blame for the thoughts, but you have some decision to express. And that's, so the original thought was, when you feel appreciation, express it. You know, if it's appropriate, not if it's inappropriate or whatever, you know, but if it feels right, why wait until somebody's memorial service to talk about how wonderful they were? Why don't you let them know, you know, I really appreciate this about you. When somebody says that to you, you feel that connection. Here's I'll just share this anecdote since it's coming to my mind. Again, about I had mentioned Sylvia Borstein to a few people. One of the Spirit Rock teachers, she says, at one Awakening Joy class, Sylvia Borstein told a story about how becoming aware of what she was thinking helped reframe the whole experience, how mindfulness changes things. One evening when she was staying in New York, she'd arranged to meet a friend for a theater performance and decided to take a bus to get there. As the bus crept along through the heavy traffic, Sylvia started worrying. I'm going to be late. I'll miss the curtain. My friend will worry about what happened to me. I shouldn't have taken the bus. The subway would have been so much faster. Figuring she could walk faster than the bus was going, Sylvia got off. And of course, as I'm walking, the bus passes me by. And now I'm thinking, I should have taken a cab. And now, Sylvia's been meditating for many years, but she's also, by her own admission, been fretting for many years. Fretting, worrying. So it was easy to see that reaction. So she continues her story, describing how she's running down Broadway in high heels with a cold wind whipping around her. And then all of a sudden she says, I have a thought. Oh, what am I doing? Oh, I'm grumbling. That's a moment of mindfulness. Up until then, I was caught up in a habit-driven narrative, an editorial comment about what was happening. But the moment at which the mind says, oh, Sylvia, dear, you're grumbling, the lens switches, and suddenly the truth of that moment is, I'm a 71-year-old woman running down Broadway in the middle of winter in high heels. That is far out. That is an extremely fortunate thing to be able to do. It changed everything. I felt proud, and I actually hoped a lot of people saw me. So you can see how just in a moment of mindfulness from, I'm going to be late, to, oh dear, you're grumbling. Oh, hey, look at that. Pretty far out. In a moment, you just switch your relationship to your experience. That's one of the ways that mindfulness works. So, mindfulness applied to a wholesome state is really powerful, and when you express it, it's even more powerful, especially in gratitude. Okay, so now we'll get to these some of these other wholesome states. There, I picked 10 in all. There's more wholesome states, but these are the ones that particularly have struck me in the teachings. So the fourth one, which can be a little paradoxical, is the fact that when we embrace our sorrows and our difficulties, this can lead to joy. This one I call finding joy in difficult times. Lest you think, oh, this is only about feeling good and putting a smile on your face. No. You know, the first noble truth in the Buddhist teachings is there's suffering in life. And if you try to pretend or escape or close your eyes, you're going to be spending your whole time trying to avoid what's here. But if we learn to open to our suffering skillfully, then there's a whole other possibility. And when I think of people who most embody joy, they are people who really know how to work with suffering. There's two people well known by everyone who really embody joy. Anyone think of one?
Dalai Lama.
The Dalai Lama. He comes to my mind too. And if you've ever been around the Dalai Lama, you've seen how he has this lightness and this joy, and yet he is continually opening to the suffering and the sorrow. His country taken from him, he in exile, hearing one story after another of torture and horrible things happening, and he's the one that the refugees or who've been in prison go to when they finally get to India and if they can escape. And there he is hearing their stories. And yet he has all this joy. It's so extraordinary. And I've seen him, and it's not so uncommon, this sight, where he can hear somebody sharing their sorrow and their grief and tears coming down his cheeks, just being so moved. And then 15 or 20 minutes later, he's giggling and laughing. How is that possible? It's the way I see it. It moves so quickly through him. It doesn't stick, and he's not overwhelmed. He feels it deeply, and then it can move through. And he can feel the sorrow, and he can feel the joy. The other person who comes to my mind is Desmond Tutu, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, also who has this infectious joy. And he was the architect of the reconciliation after apartheid ended. And hearing again, just like the Dalai Lama, one awful story after another, and somehow coming to lead a country in forgiveness. hearing all of those stories, and yet, just like the Dalai Lama, it doesn't stick and overwhelm. He feels it fully, and then he can be light. So this is pretty extraordinary to be able to do that. And it's possible that we can do it. In one of the teachings that I love from the Buddha, he says, suffering can be a causative factor for faith to arise. Faith can lead to gladness. Gladness can lead to joy, can lead to happiness, contentment, peace, all the way to enlightenment. This, by the way, this teaching, if you want to Google it and impress your friends, is called Transcendental Dependent Arising. Very lofty name. Suffering can lead to faith, can lead to gladness, joy, etc. Let me ask you, how many people here have been motivated by suffering in their own life to look for answers and a deeper meaning of where happiness lies? Look around. This is how it works. Even though it seems so strange, would you say, oh great, I can't wait for some more suffering so I can have some more faith? No. But suffering shakes us out of our complacency and thinking, oh yes, everything is fine. And we see we don't have control over life. And we want to look, where is happiness truly found? Just like the Buddha was motivated. And we go looking and seeking for answers. And we find some teachings, whether it's Buddhism or other beautiful teachings, that point to a deeper kind of happiness. Let me ask you to just reflect for a moment. I'd like you to go inside and, looking back on your life, think of a challenging situation or a period that you went through, that you've gone through. And just reflect, what lessons did you learn going through that? How did it help you grow? Let's just, without getting into the details of the story, just the essence of the lessons. What, any lessons that that you can share? Just putting it in a few words. Yes,
Patrick. I'm myself responsible for my own happiness.
I myself am responsible for my own happiness, suffering, happiness. Okay, that it's in here. Right. There's many lessons. Anyone else?
Not closing my eyes.
Say it again?
Not closing my eyes.
Not closing my eyes, being willing to look directly at experience. Yes, having the courage to. Yeah.
Forgiveness.
Forgiveness. Yeah. It's a powerful one. Thank you. There was some other hands. Yes.
That I am brave.
Say again?
That I am brave.
That you're brave. See the courage in there that you didn't know you had. That's often one of the gifts in suffering. Wow, I didn't know I had it in me. Yeah.
I'm not alone.
Yes. Beautiful. So many, and we could probably have as many people as there are in this room, as many answers. Isn't that interesting how that works? So it's not so much that we should avoid suffering, and it's not that we should look for suffering. You know, sometimes people say, oh, okay, step four, now I've got to look at all the suffering in my life, you know, oh, well, let me see if I look, pick up under this wrap, yeah, there's some suffering there. No, you're not looking for suffering. But when it comes your way, there's something that you can learn from it. In that that book, How We Choose to Be Happy, remember I read Adele's story last night? One of the nine choices that they had as a common denominator for all of those 320 happy people was what they call recasting, where your sorrow is somehow recast in a way that helps you grow. So you find some meaning in it. You let yourself feel it and you find some meaning in it. This is from Khalil Gibran, who wrote The Prophet, beautiful, beautiful book. He says, your joy is your sorrow unmasked. And the self-same well from which your laughter rises was oftentimes filled with your tears. And how else can it be? The deeper that sorrow carves into your being, the more joy you can contain. Because when life touches us deeply, we are we're learning its lessons, and our heart is tenderized and open and can not only open to the sorrow, but has that much more capacity to open to the full dimension and blessings of life. It can. It doesn't necessarily have to, because like in that teaching it says, sorrow can be the causative factor for joy to arise. Sometimes sorrow can lead to bitterness and can lead to contraction and can lead to fear and can lead to denial, all of those things. That's possible too. So I'm not saying, oh yes, how wonderful all the sorrow in this world. But if you know how to use sorrow wisely, your measure of pain that life is giving you can be the transformation of deep compassion. And that's one of the things that we've been doing since we've been here, just learning to hold our pain and our suffering with kindness and compassion. And little by little, it starts to work. Oh, yeah. Oh, it hurts in here. Oh, I can be kind. Oh, this is part of life. Oh, all the people in the world who are going through what I'm going through right now, and you don't feel quite so alone. This is from the great spiritual teacher Sri Aurobindo's partner, the mother, she was called. Sri Aurobindo is a great Hindu sage who lived in India in the 20th century. And the mother, it was his partner. She says, you carry in yourself all the obstacles necessary to make your realization perfect. Always you will see that within you there is the shadow and the light. If you discover a very black hole, a thick shadow, be sure there is somewhere in you a great light. It is up to you to know how to use the one to realize the other. So this is our opportunity to really see the possibility of working with our suffering as a way to deepen us and open up to all of life. Because our usual reaction or relationship is, no, I don't want to feel it. Understandable, But when you find that you have the courage to feel it, then you are willing to open up to everything. Just a little at a time. You don't want to go in more than is your capacity, but little by little, titrating your dukkha. Just a little at a time. And we've talked about some ways to work with our suffering or our sorrow. One is that RAIN acronym, to really let yourself feel it a little at a time. Another is the self-compassion practice that holds it. And also, knowing what your limits are. If it's too much, you don't need to keep on going in. You can open up, walking in nature. And this is whether it's on here on retreat or in your daily life. When it's too much, there's lots of different ways to work with it and get some space. So walking in nature, actually, let me ask you, how do you work with your suffering when it gets to be too much and you can't quite hold it all? What is it? Anything that you can think of that you do that's helpful? Say again?
Sauna.
Yeah. Right on. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Feeling, nourishing yourself. Sauna, purification. We do hot baths or a massage or something that nourishes you and grounds you. Yeah. What else?
Talking with friends.
Say again?
Talking with friends,
reaching out. You don't have to do this by yourself. And somehow when somebody is there to really understand, I'm not carrying it all alone. Absolutely. Yeah. Sorry.
This is connected with the nature. I look at the sky and then I feel more spacious.
Looking at the sky and getting a sense of space. Yes. Anything else?
Hug my dogs.
What's that?
Hug my dogs.
Hug your dogs. That's it. Pets are one of the best, you know. They're there loving you no matter what. Yeah.
Sometimes physical exercise.
Yes, discharging. When it's too much, you just let the body release some of that energy. All of these things. Anything else that was it? Yeah,
singing.
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 Beautiful. That's my main therapy. When all else fails, I sing. In fact, in the Joy Course, I say to people, okay, if you really want to do this, sing every day. And if you're feeling really lousy, sing the blues. But that's what the blues are for. For me, I put on early Bob Dylan and really let it out. You got a lot of nerve. Just, all right, let it out. But singing, or singing something joyful that lifts you up. And creative expression, just letting it out of you, writing or dancing, whatever. So you have this wisdom in you. And it's good to see that when suffering or sorrow comes, and as I said yesterday, you feel your losses fully. It's not like you're saying, oh no, I should be happy. You let yourself feel the grieving. Have somebody around to help you with it. And feel the sadness, feel the pain, but not to feel that, oh, I'm stuck here, or because this happened to me, this is who I am. A few other keys to working with dukkha that I find helpful. Not projecting into the future. This moment might be difficult, but when the mind says, I know what's ahead. And when you're in that negative state, your mind will create the worst reality. And so we keep on frightening ourselves like those painted tigers. You, yeah. But there's no running away because you're in your mind, in your head. So not projecting into the future, the refuge is here in the present moment. That's one of the gifts of mindfulness. Oh, come back to now. Like we were saying in one of the groups, another of Sylvia Boorstein's tips, she says, if you're having a meltdown and all of a sudden you wake up and you're on the meditation cushion, just notice, oh, is this an in-breath or an out-breath? The whole drama dissolves. You say, let's see, in-breath? Oh yeah, in-breath. Oh, what was I freaked out about a moment ago? But coming here into the present moment is where the refuge is. Something else, to not take it so solid when you're having a really difficult time, we can somehow feel, oh, this period is going to be a bleak period, a dark period. I'm in the pits this week or this month or this year. But you'll miss out on the fact that there are actually many moments of okayness even within there. You might see some children playing and for a moment have a lightness of heart. Then you might think, oh, I'm supposed to be depressed. Hold on, I'm going to go back here. Let that solidity break up and let yourself be nourished by moments of well-being. Non-identification, not taking it personally. This is not my fear or anxiety. It's just this mind state that's coming here and can be held. What am I learning right now? What's the lesson in this? And learning to be present with it. All of these things. I think I'll just move on. There's a lot more to say about it, but I think I'll just move on here. So that's the fourth. And the gratitude creates the space so that you can open up to the difficulties. So the fifth in this, that I put in this sequence, which is the foundation for inner peace, is integrity, is living a life aligned with our values. You know, we took those guidelines, those precepts at the beginning of the retreat, not killing, not stealing, not causing harm through sexuality, not causing harm through speech, and not abusing substances. The Buddha says these and the spirit of non-harming is what can lead to inner peace. Because if we are causing suffering to others or to ourselves, it disturbs our heart. You've seen that probably. And it's so interesting how we can know better, but still go ahead and do something unskillful. We all do. We're, you know, unless you are fully enlightened, we're all human and we make mistakes. But if you keep on learning, then nothing is wasted. But to see inside, the more I'm aligned with my values, the more I have an ease in my heart. The Buddha talked about this. He called this, and this is the title of the chapter in my book, is his phrase, the bliss of blamelessness. The bliss of blamelessness. When you don't have anything to feel guilty about or blameworthy, there's a great sense of openness and ease. And he talks in one discourse, he talks about four kinds of happiness that anybody can experience, whether or not they've ever meditated. There's the happiness that comes from being free of debt, very practical, which is probably a lot, from what I've seen, a bit different in Finland than it is in the States. I don't know, maybe there's some debt, but in the States it's so painful. People go to college and then they're saddled in this last decade with huge debt, and it's such a weight. And so many, the American way is, plastic, I can get anything I want. Right? So being free of debt is a great source of happiness. Having enough prosperity that you can be generous with those who you care about. That feels good, doesn't it? A third is to be fortunate enough that you can be generous with people even outside of your circle. It feels really good to be generous. And then the fourth is this bliss of blamelessness, where you haven't caused harm or suffering to others. And he says in this discourse that compared to the bliss of blamelessness, those first three are not 1/16 the power of happiness and well-being as that bliss of blamelessness. I don't know how he figured that out, but that's what it says. But you know, even if you have good fortune, if you're out of integrity, if you are causing harm or suffering, it weighs in your heart, it weighs in your mind. So here's a little exercise to give you a sense of how this works, how actually in every moment we are sowing the seeds for more suffering or more happiness, whether or not we realize it. So I invite you to close your eyes and think of some act that you regret, that maybe you weren't so skillful. Maybe you clicked the send button on the angry email or said some sharp words to someone or whatever comes to mind. And as you recall it, you can see four different ways that you're planting seeds of suffering. One, how did it feel the moment after you did it? Maybe it felt good for a moment, but if you're being hurtful or sharp or unkind, it probably doesn't feel good soon after. So that's one way. What's the energy that comes back to you from whoever is on the receiving end? They probably didn't say, oh, thank you for your feedback. And they probably set up an energy between you that is not so pleasant. The recollection, as you're thinking of it right now, how does it feel? Probably not so good. And the likelihood that you will do it again is greater because you practiced that habit in that moment. And we are creatures of habit. So that's four ways that an unskillful act leads to suffering. Okay, that's the not such good news. I won't leave you here again. So take a nice deep breath. Stay inside. And now I'd like you to think of something really skillful that you've done. There for a friend, really expressing your caring or your kindness, or your generosity, just spontaneously coming out of you. And as you think about this situation, four ways that you're planting wholesome seeds. First, how did it feel in the moment that you did it? Probably pretty good. What is the energy that comes back to you? Probably appreciation or connection. As you're recalling it right now, how does it feel? Probably pretty good, doesn't it? And the likelihood that you will practice that way is greater because you planted that seed and practiced that habit. Okay? You can open your eyes. So, four ways that you're planting seeds for wholesomeness when you act with skill. Four ways that you're planting seeds of suffering when you don't. When I first heard that, it made me realize, whoa, I want to clean up my act. Because I am creating my suffering or happiness in a very direct way. So this is a way to experience well-being and joy. Every time you choose the high road, every time you choose to act skillfully, feel good about it. Don't just say, oh yeah, well that's the way I'm supposed to do it. No. When you're about to click that send button and you say, wait, maybe just let me wait overnight and read it tomorrow and just see. I don't know. Feel really good about it. And every time you act with skill and kindness, notice how good that feels. So you're inclining towards more and more in that direction. Now, of course, like I said, we blow it and we forget and we make mistakes. So this also means to learn to forgive ourselves. And we can carry around our pain and our suffering for a long time and having regret and guilt. I was mentioning it in one of the groups today. We were talking about that. I know guilt. I come from a lineage of guilt. And if you just know, if you see my YouTube, my mom, Confessions of a Jewish Mother, she talks about how Jewish mothers are famous for laying on guilt. You know, oh, you haven't called me in so long. Oh, that hurts so much. So, I do know that. And we laughed about it, so don't worry. We had a good relationship. She could at least laugh about it. But guilt just perpetuates the pain. All you do is keep on thinking about what a rotten person you are, or go ahead and do something else that's equally rotten to confirm what a rotten person you are. And it just is self-perpetuating. The Buddha talked about, instead of guilt, wise remorse, where he said, look at what you've done and learn from it. If you've done something unskillful, then see what you can learn and make a commitment to doing it differently in the future. Then there's no mistakes. As long as you're learning, there's no mistakes. Something else that you might consider at your choice point, should I or shouldn't I? You know that point that you get to, let's see. Should I or shouldn't I? click the send button, go for the third dessert, do get this quick hit, it's going to feel so good. Or, I'm justified, yes. And there's a part of you that maybe is not so sure. Listen to that. Because chances are, if you're mindful and there's a part of you that says, I don't know. And if you really listen inside, you can perhaps jump ahead to the future and ask yourself, how is this going to feel looking back? That's the magic reflection, because on the front end, it feels so good. Yeah, I know this is going to be hot. And on the back end, what was I thinking? And there's so much more mind moments of cleaning up than the mind moments on the front end. So if you can leap forward and say, oh, how will this feel a few weeks from now or a few months from now? You might save yourself a lot of hassle, because it's right in there that you know. Okay, so that's the fifth. I can see we won't get to too many more of these. And it is getting stuffy again in here. Maybe we can... Is the sauna happening? It feels like a sauna in here. Okay, so this is another basis. So really acting with ethics and forgiving ourselves, and we don't have to go through a forgiveness. Forgiveness is really powerful, like you were saying, Anna. It cleans up the slate, and you're the one that benefits from forgiveness for yourself and for others. Maybe we can fit in a forgiveness someplace in before we end. But I want to go on to the sixth, which is what I call the joy of letting go. And we talked about it, like the monkey trap, how when you let go, it's so freeing. And I read that Ajahn Chah quote, let go a little, you have a little freedom, let go a lot, you have a lot of freedom, let go completely, you have complete freedom. To notice every time you have a choice to let go. It was so beautiful, some of the sharings in the groups about letting go of those thoughts, letting go believing in those thoughts. Letting go operates on a number of different levels. One very practical level is letting go of stuff. I mentioned Real Simple in here, that Real Simple magazine. It feels so much better to get to declutter. But we're continually bombarded with, oh, you need this, you need that. So letting go of stuff, and I want to share with you a simple teaching on letting go from the Buddhist teaching on moderation. This is from a Buddhist scholar, P.A. Paiuto. The principle of moderation, where true happiness lies, an awareness of that optimum point where the enhancement of true well-being coincides with the experience of satisfaction. Consumption balanced to an amount appropriate with well-being rather than the satisfaction of one desire after another. In contrast to maximum consumption, leading to more satisfaction. We have moderate or wise consumption, leading to well-being. So basically, it's knowing when enough is enough. That takes some mindfulness and wisdom, because the way the game is set up, gratification leads to more wanting. Oh, that felt so good to get that gratification, and I'll get the next one and the next one, and if I put them close enough together, I've won. That's happiness. But it never ends. And so to just know, oh, this is satisfying. Yes, this is just the right amount. Okay. So there's letting go of stuff, and this world really needs to learn to do with less, particularly our country, which consumes way more than our share. And it's, we are addicted to stuff. So many other countries aspire to be like us. This is an unsustainable world like that. So there's letting go of stuff, there's letting go of busyness and time. Oh, and like we were saying in one of the groups, the disease FOMS, fear of missing something. Oh, yeah, there's that. Oh, and there's that. Oh, and there's that. And, oh, if I just add this onto my plate, then, it's going to be so good. But not realizing too much on your plate, you get indigestion. And if you find yourself very busy, how many people find themselves very busy? It's a disease, and often we wear it like a badge. Yes, I'm a very busy person. I must really be doing important things.
Yeah. Hey, you are.
Huh?
You are.
Oh. No. I didn't mean it that way. I was speaking for all of us. This is from a very, very wise woman who lived in. She was an American in the last century. Her name was Peace Pilgrim, and she went around the last 30 years of her life just with a toothbrush and with very simple, very, very wise, going around and meeting people and teaching them about peace. And this is what she says. If your life is in harmony with your part in the life pattern, and if you are obedient to the laws which govern this universe, then your life is full and good, but not overcrowded. If it is overcrowded, you're doing more than is right for you to do, more than is your job to do in the total scheme of things. That's a hard one. But people who have balance in their life are such models and such inspirations, particularly if you're a parent with children, and of course you want to just be running around and taking care, and it's important. But if you can model balance as well, this is a great message to give to your children as well. You're not cheating, you're actually modeling. So you might think of ways to simplify your life. And then there's another aspect of letting go. I can see this is going to be a three-part talk. And that is letting go of the stories that we tell ourselves. This is the big letting go. And it's been so moving to hear people share their stories and get a glimpse. This is a story that I've told myself, and maybe there's another way to hold it. We all have our own history. We all have our own sorrows and pains. But if you are saying, because this happened to me at this time, I can never, and you can fill in the blank, or I always, and you can fill in the blank, and limit yourself, then you're really doing yourself, you're missing out, and you're recreating a reality over and over and over. Instead of, oh, because this happened to me, I've learned this lesson, or I'm learning another way, and I can be there for others in that possibility. So I'd like you one more little exercise to do. Close your eyes for a moment. So this is about letting go of the stories. What story do you tell yourself that might limit who you are? Either about yourself or about how others are or about life. If one comes about you, oh, this is why I can never, or this is my flaw that I somehow can't fix, or something about your past. And now, what would happen if you see this as just a story? Yes, this might have happened, but this isn't the whole story. This doesn't have to limit me. What if it was part of a bigger story? And what would help you remember that this is simply a story? We tell ourselves stories all the time. Why not tell ourselves stories that really serve us and bring out the best in us? So every time you can see that story for what it is, and it takes practice because it's been developed for a long time, but each time you see it, oh, there's that story. For me, I think I shared this in one of the groups, one of my main practices when I get caught, maybe I shared it in the hall, I say to myself when I remember, oh, what story am I believing right now? Sometimes I'll say, what thought am I believing right now? And as soon as I see it's just a story, then there's another possibility. So to let go of the stories that limit who you are and discover who you really are. And the ultimate letting go, we talked about this in the greed, hatred, and delusion, is the generous heart. So I think I'll end here, and I'll end with a poem on letting go called, surprisingly enough, let it go. This is, again, another poem by Dana Falls, the one who did Awakening Now and Awareness, Knowing Itself. She says, let go of the ways you thought life would unfold. The holding of plans or dreams or expectations, let it all go. Save your strength to swim with the tide. The choice to fight what is here before you now will only result in struggle, fear, and desperate attempts to flee from the very energy you long for. Let it go. Let it all go and flow with the grace that washes through your days, whether you receive it gently or with all your quills raised to defend against invaders, quills, porcupine quills, with all your quills raised to defend against invaders. Take this on faith. The mind may never find the explanation that it seeks, but you will move forward nonetheless. Let go, and the wave's crest will carry you to unknown shores, beyond your wildest dreams or destinations. Let it all go and find the place of rest and peace and certain transformation. So these are the the next steps in this awakening joy. Embracing the difficult, living with integrity, alignment with our values, the joy of letting go. Tomorrow we'll get to the heart practices. Loving ourselves, connection with others, compassion in the world, and the joy of simply being. So let's take a moment and just let the words settle.